Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 31. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode will be the continuation of my interview with Alan Piper, so I'm going to keep things short since we already introduced him in the last episode. Upcoming shows will be Dr. Neil Goldsmith, Psychedelics and Psycho-Spiritual Development, and G. Edward Griffin, The Creature from Jekyll Island on the Federal Reserve. I think that's a very important mystery that needs to be explored. Also coming up soon, I hope to have Professor Benny Shannon on, the author of Antipodes of the Mind. He has not gotten back to me to confirm a specific date yet, so I hope to get that done soon. As far as the Pharmacratic Inquisition video, the Russian and German versions are still in process. I have not had time to finish plugging in all of the German text, and I did hear from Max today that they're still working on the Russian version, so hopefully those will be done soon. The DVD is available for free viewing on the Pharmacratic Inquisition website in Dutch, Portuguese, Spanish, and English. Go to www.pharmacraticinquisition.com. That's pharmacraticinquisition.com. And if you're listening to the show and would like to help with other language editions of the video, like French or Arabic or the many other languages out there, I would love to add those languages to the DVD and online versions of the video if you would like to help with that. Also, I still need help with transcriptions for those of you who would possibly be able to help with that. If you're interested in maybe helping with the show and can't donate, that's a great way to help, and your help is greatly appreciated and needed right now. I've been sort of overloaded with things to do the last couple of weeks, and the piles of work are only getting bigger, not smaller. And the show is run on donations. If you would like to support this programming, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page, or you can also click on the donations button on the gnosticmedia.podomatic.com page and get to the same place on there. This show is not corporate media. This is independent media in the truest sense of the words, and by supporting it, you help continue our programming. And without your help, we cease to be here. And I know times are tough for everyone out there. So, if you can help, we really appreciate it more than ever right now. And times are really tough for us right now, too. So we really appreciate everyone who's been donating. And anyway, also, to help the show, you can go to the website and buy a copy of the DVD or one of my books, like The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, that I wrote, published in October last year, or the brand new second edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism that was just released a couple of months ago in both color and black and white versions. And you can get that from www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. And also on the website, down on the bottom right, are the She Who Remembers audio archives. If you haven't checked those out yet, you definitely want to see what's available there. All kinds of great archived material from Terrence McKenna, New World Order type stuff, everything you can think of. And in fact, this weekend, the daughter of She Who Remembers, and She Who Remembers, who is Jeannie Brittingham Erstad, she died in April of 2002 and sort of left me in charge of her archives. And this weekend I received a call from her daughter that she was having to move this weekend, and she called me right away to come over and pick up box fulls of more archives and videos and everything. So what I've got in there is, let's see, a party that we all went to at Dr. Timothy Leary's house in 1994. I've got several videotapes of many of the hemp rallies that were done in LA and throughout California during the 90s, especially the early 90s. All kinds of archive news. She basically collected everything news-wise surrounding September 11. And so there's probably almost 100 tapes just on that, and just an overall plethora of information. So if you're somebody who is interested in that type of information or helping to get that information encoded or digitized so that we can get it up online, I would appreciate your help with that as well. And thanks for everyone for your support. We greatly appreciate it. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. If you would like to contact me, you can contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Once again, gnosticmedia.com. And here is part two of my interview with Alan Piper. Enjoy the show. Would you like to talk about religions and shamanism?
All right, yes. Well, religions, meaning to say the idea of somewhere back in prehistory, there's some kind of original religion. Of course, we can only speculate about the nature of religion or religious ideas and experiences amongst our prehistoric ancestors, but really this arises in the context of mushrooms and the idea that mushrooms perhaps were the source of religious ideas. Now that was something which I think that that Gordon Wasson contributed to, suggesting that that mushrooms, or for that matter other psychoactive plants, may actually be the origin of religious ideas. And so on. The issue here really is that a number of anthropologists and paleoanthropologists have challenged the kind of assumption on some people's part, potentially I suppose on Wasson's part, that that our remote ancestors were necessarily shamanistic and be using entheogenic drugs. I think the fundamental criticism that is raised is saying, well, you can't simply extrapolate from the current practices of cultures who are still actively shamanistic to our ancestors. We simply don't know. There's no way that you can make that assumption that the practices of our remote ancestors were similar to contemporary shamanism. And of course it relies partly on the notion that those indigenous peoples who make use of psychoactive plants are in some sense primitive, and that they do represent some earlier phase of human evolution, which maybe nowadays we would see as being somewhat insulting to them, to say that, you know, they represent a lower level and an earlier level of development. I think there's some other spins that one can put on that, because plainly these are cultures which are not urbanized. They're not structured in the way that's hard, you know, that urbanized, politicized kind of cultures are. But the way in which I'd approach this myself and this fundamental criticism is perhaps to come at it from a fundamentally different angle. And it returns us to writers like Giorgio Sammarini and his writings about animals and psychedelics. And also to Siegel's book, Intoxication. And anybody who's really interested in the history the history in terms of human usage of plant intoxicants really should have a look at those books, because my approach would be this, that Siegel in his book Intoxication, as well as postulating that the desire to be intoxicated, the search for plants, for example, that intoxicates you, is what he calls a fourth drive. That's presumably after sex and shelter and food, as well as positing that it's that important or that central to human existence. Both he, very extensively, and of course Giorgio Sammarini as well in his book Animals and Psychedelics, demonstrate that that animals seek out actively psychoactive plants and return to them and obviously enjoy the experience of intoxication. Now, my reading from that is to say, as well as the fact that intoxication is a fundamental drive, and there's another point I'd like to make about that, to me that's extremely suggestive, and I think it's a reasonable extrapolation to say that not only would ancient man have been making use of a plant intoxicants, now let's forget for the moment about religion, but not only man but also our proto-human ancestors were almost certainly making use consciously of psychoactive plants. I feel that's a reasonable extrapolation. I wouldn't feel qualified to move into the area necessarily of religion amongst our most remote ancestors. But I mean, once you get to the stage looking at the Vedic scriptures and so on, and the role of Homer, certainly that's the context in which entheogens found themselves in the earliest recordings we have of religion. But there was something else I wanted to say about that I've lost for the moment, which is one of the difficulties in researchers, as you're well aware, Jan, is the kind of prejudice against the idea of the use of drugs in a religious context, for example, but almost in any context. When we say drugs, of course, we use this word drugs to mean not our drugs of choice, to say alcohol and tobacco and caffeine and so on. Drugs is always pejorative, isn't it? It means, you know, heroin or crack or cannabis or LSD or some substance that has been demonized. But I always find it extraordinary that to contemplate the fact that in our Western culture, it's completely normal to be under the influence of drugs 24/7. That's to say, if you're a user of caffeine, of tobacco, and of alcohol on a daily basis, there's not an hour during the day during which you're not under the influence of a psychoactive substance. And this is normal.
Not to mention all the Prozac and Zoloft and all the other stuff. Meanwhile, they're talking out of the sides of their head, damning drugs, while they're popping pills left and right, and the American television is just filled with commercials advertising all of these pharmaceutical drugs. And of course, they're always caveated at the end with a list of a dozen, two dozen, three dozen dangerous side effects and all of these things that they have to, may cause diarrhea, heart attack, instant death, whatever, you know, and the list of things.
But it'll be a slow yeah, struggle, Jan, for this to be overcome. That is the difficulty. Can I give you another example?
I was just going to say it's just a bizarre double standard, but go ahead.
Oh, if I can put it into another context, in a sense, which is to say that return to New Testament studies. Now, as you're well aware, I'm sure, in the late 19th century, you had the gradual emergence following the Enlightenment and the sort of awareness of other cultures and the sort of growing science, if you like, of anthropology and so on, and study of other cultures. There was a gradual academic awareness and followed by a popular awareness of the religious practices and the mythologies and so on of other cultures. And amongst that, of course, was an awareness that that the Christian mythological cycle, if you like, of the Savior who you have his childhood, then he disappears, then he returns with a mission, then he's betrayed, and then he's killed, and he's going to return at the end of time, and so on. That these structures, the same stories with a number of variations, existed in cultures right across the world. And plainly, biblical scholarship as it was then, and as it has evolved from the late 19th century to today, has had to contend with those issues, the fact that those stories are repeated, that the structures have been analysed. So how can we claim that the Christian story is, you know, a divine revelation and is unique in some way? But that hasn't blown away the Christian church. You know, the church is able to accommodate itself to those things. So I sometimes think to myself, well, if they discovered the tomb of Christ, of Mary and Joseph in Jerusalem next week, and it proved that his mission was more Life of Brian, shall we say, Monty Python, than it was according to the Gospel of St. Mark, the church wouldn't disappear overnight. It wouldn't be destroyed. You know, it would accommodate it. And carry on.
Though their religion is based on the rising up of this, Son of God, if Jesus didn't rise up, it would certainly pose some major problems for the central story that they've passed down through things like the Nicene Creed for the last.
Some way they would accommodate it. I mean,
you're probably right.
Because the historicity of Christ has been in question since the late 19th century, the historicity of the Gospel, which of course aren't history. There were never accounts in the sense that we think of it as history. That's the difficulty. This is where you come back to issues relating to things like the history of ideas. You know, the Gospels have to be understood in the context of the time, you know, where if your story about your God owes, oh my God, went up through seven heavens, oh well, our God went up through ten, you know, just to add events, you know, to maximize the glory of your own particular Savior was not seen as deceit. It's just part of the hagiography, you know, the developing hagiography.
They're trying to one better each other in a way.
But if I could return to Seligman and my suggestion anyway, that entheogens must almost certainly have been part of the diet, shall we say, of our proto-human ancestors, as well as, you know, our fully human ancestors, if you like. This seems a realistic proposition to me, and it says that entheogens must have had a role of some sort in the development of human consciousness. I'm not saying that they necessarily Genesis says so, triggered our self-awareness or whatever it may be. But it returns me to an issue I wanted to ask you if you've had this experience, Jan, which is to say that certainly when I've taken psychedelics and maybe for the first time, when you have that experience, it has a familiarity, you know, it's almost as if you say, hello, I've been here before, you're thinking, recognize this as if it belongs to something natural.
Right. Well, you know, it's something that you feel you've done many, if not hundreds of times. It feels like that's where it feels like you're going home almost, you know.
That's exactly what I mean. And you recognize that. I'm very pleased.
Very much so. I've definitely experienced that on a number of occasions. And
you know, that's something that's always interested me, because, you know, whether or not you've done entheogens once or 100 times or you haven't, when you have that type of experience, it's like you're really remembering where you have already been and where you're coming from.
Yes, and the point that I would make there, Jan, is my feeling there is that possibly that means that the entheogenic experience is part of our inheritance, if you like, and that to be denied that experience, you know, by laws or prejudice, it may be to deny human individuals an experience which is something fundamental to being human,
and
to understand what it means to be human.
I think the fact that we have cannabinoid receptors and opioid receptors and DMT receptors, and the fact that we have DMT in our red blood cells and our lungs and our cerebral spinal fluid, I think that these experiences have to be part of our origin of who we are, of what we are. You know, to me, I guess that's something, you know, and I know it's questioned by many, but to me it's something that is not even questionable.
No, of course, the issue in terms of science is it has to be articulated. If we want to go into convince
right.
a skeptical academia, then a scholarly argument has to be developed. And so, I mean,
here's the scholarly argument. The scholarly argument should go something as, here, eat this.
Well, yes. And I mean, talking about simple arguments is, yes, we'll have the experience and you'll know. But indeed. But I mean, that returns me to another issue, which relates and brings me back to the history of ideas, really, that my original project when I kind of got involved was I wanted to prove the entheogenic theory of religious history, as it were. That was my commitment. That's what I wanted to do. And it's a project that I've really largely abandoned simply through lack of resources. But in terms of continuity, cultural continuity, I mean, you know, academics will want the roots, you know, the detailed roots of cultural transmission demonstrated, or potential roots, credible roots demonstrated. But in terms of Christianity and the Indo-European religion, if you want to call it that, as a whole, the root is superficially extremely clear. That's to say, we have an ancient Indo-European religion which was recorded in the Vedas, that refer to traditions that go back thousands of years before Christ, and central to that religious practice is the soma. It's not the only element, but it's central to that practice, the use of a psychoactive of substance and traditions that relate to that. And it's present also in the Iranian traditions as well, which coexisted with Christianity and the emergence of Christianity. And somewhere there's a link between the Zoroastrian tradition, certainly, and Christianity, and some of that has been teased out a little bit. But there's this great caution, you know. I mean, the difficulty with the study of Christian history, or the history of the Gospels and all of that, is that the majority of scholars were Christians until really quite recently, until, you know, probably 20 or 30 years ago. And there was an assumption that in some sense that the Gospels were essentially historical, or some kind of historical record of Christ's mission and so on. And so there's the academic world has a great inertia in accepting new ideas and moving. You know, there's a huge weight of opinion sitting on the other side, you know, before you can emerge with a hypothesis that is going to challenge the dominant view, you know. But you have this clear picture this clear into European tradition, the Vedas, Zoroastrianism, Mithraism, potentially as a link between the Iranian traditions and the influence of Iranian traditions on Christianity, which, and coming back again to New Testament scholarship and New Testament studies, when I was dipping into the New Testament and New Testament studies, even relatively conservative Christian scholarship has to accept and recognizes really that Christianity was a Hellenistic mystery religion. That's what it was, and that's what it still is in terms of its actual physical being, you know.
Right.
And so there's a fairly simple, obvious continuity there, but the difficulty is teasing out the details and demonstrating the clear roots of transmission, at least in purely historical terms, you know, but at least in terms of doing a certain kind of history, if you like. But then, you know, it may be rather more obvious in other ways if you're approaching it purely from a sort of mythological perspective. So Karl Ruck's writings, for example, I remember saying to Karl once, "Oh, your writings are very Gravesian," you know, Robert Graves. And what I meant by that was that that Karl writes, he's immersed in the language of myth. He has a profound understanding of myth. And when Karl was talking to you in your recent podcast, I think he was talking about Odysseus and the journey of Odysseus as being a shamanic journey, not a physical journey. And he was saying, well, this is a little hard to understand, yeah. But of course, it's not hard to understand if you understand the metaphors, if you understand that language. Many years ago, I remember I had a little book called A Dictionary for Dreamers. It's still published, still available by someone called Tom Chetwynd. It's a brilliant little book. It's not one of these kind of, you know, if you dream of X, you'll be coming into money. It's kind of Jungian, you know, in its approach. And when I was reading that, just browsing through that, there was something I thought was very interesting that he said, which was a reference in a dream to one part of your body, or for that matter, I suppose, another person's body, maybe a reference to a different part of the body. Well, that might sound a little what's Alan talking about when he says that. But I'll give you a couple of examples. So, in Greek mythology, Zeus king killed Semele, but he saved their son Dionysus, didn't he? And he sewed Dionysus into his thigh. And he incubated him in his thigh. Now, what is that about? Well, it's an image of male gestation, isn't it? But fairly plainly, his thigh actually refers to his penis. You know, that's where you're going to gestate if you're a male. And if you look at discussions of that myth, I'm not the only person who would suggest that's the point. Now, interestingly, Pythagoras, by tradition, had a golden thigh. Now, what does that mean? Why would Pythagoras have a golden thigh? And apparently he, according, I think, to Aristotle or to tradition anyway, he displayed this thigh at the Olympic Games, the saucy old devil. What was he displaying exactly? I don't know. But it's interesting, isn't it? And it set me thinking about Christ's wound. And I'd read a book way back then called The Wise Wound, which is a book about sort of myth and menstruation. And I thought to myself, Christ's wound gives forth blood and water. Well, what other wound gives forth blood and water? Well, the vulva gives forth blood and water. You might think, bizarre. And when I pondered this, now the sort of thought came to me many, many years ago. I hesitated to mention it to anybody because I thought, well, they think it was just too strange. I'd got a bit of a Freudian, bizarre notion in my head. But actually, if you just Google Christ's wound and vulva on the on Google Books, you'll find lots of academic references to Christ's wound being associated with the vulva. In terms of Christian symbolism.
There was,
but my point Jan, was simply to say that that the language of myth is its own language. Do you understand what I'm saying? And to say that that's one form of understanding, and it may throw up, you know, apparently bizarre or incredible notions.
What I was trying to add to that was Professor John Hupps has done some work in that regard in Maya Mesoamerican studies, and the practice of male subincision was fairly common, so that the male shaman could bleed like the female. And I really think that it's sort of an attempted assertion of the, you know, the female powers of reproduction that obviously the men didn't have, and so they were trying to bleed to become more like the female aspects. And also, I think traditionally speaking, many of the shamans were originally probably more female, because the female were more the gatherers and dealing with the plants and herbs, where the men were the hunters. And so the plants and the, you know, women would have had most likely had a stronger knowledge of the plants than the male, typically speaking. And so on several levels, it looks like just an assertion of one group from the other.
But it certainly reveals, at the very least, Christ potentially as an androgyne, yes,
right,
and that is of significance. And as I said, you know, it might seem a blasphemous thing to say, but you will find it in mainstream scholarship, the investigation of that notion.
It's a common one to me, but I know that a lot of people may be shocked by the idea. Could you tell me a bit more about the discovery of the mushroom petroglyphs in Spain and their significance?
Well, yes, these mushroom petroglyphs, it's really quite exciting. So it's a petroglyphs, that's, you know, rock art to you and me. These paintings on rock walls in caves and naturally occurring shelters, painted normally in pigments, naturally occurring pigments like red ochre and so on. Most of us are familiar with the famous ones, the caves of Lascaux and so on. Anyhow, these particular petroglyphs were brought to Carl Ruck's attention by a Spanish colleague. I think it was José Celdrón from Murcia in the first place. And I think the estimated date is something like 6000 BC or so. And they're in this rock shelter, not a cave as such, just a small overhang in a remote part of central Spain. And a copy was emailed to me some months ago. And that first copy, it was hard to make out, really, because it was like a textbook image of some sort that perhaps had been scanned, and you couldn't really tell the true dimensions and situation of the petroglyphs. But anyhow, when we got out to Spain, it's myself and Carl, and I'll tell you a bit more about the expedition in a moment. But we were lucky enough to be accompanied on that trip by a guide who had the keys to the cages, which are constructed about around the rock art to protect them, to stop people defacing them and so on. And so we were able to examine them and to photograph them in detail. I don't know if I've actually sent you any photographs, Jan, but I'm quite happy to do that.
Yeah, no, not yet, but I would love to see those.
If you've not seen them, you'll be very excited when you do. The mushroom figures themselves, the actual paintings, are about 3 or 4 centimeters high, from my recollection. You'll see them in the photograph. They're quite small, And it's a row of 13 mushroom-shaped images. As I said, each one maybe 3 centimeters or so high. And they sit on this rock, this rock wall, amongst a whole set of other images, mostly animal images. One beautiful bull image, typical, something like people would be familiar with. And other images, some faded more than others, and so on. Anyhow, 13, a row of 13 mushroom-like images. Now, 13 certainly suggested to me a calendrical connection. That's to say they're 13 lunar months. So that suggests to me, but obviously we're, you know, at a very speculative stage here, perhaps, you know, seasonal usage or ritual usage on a regular basis, perhaps. Anyhow, they were not unknown. This is not a brand new discovery. The site itself is well known, and they were discovered in, I think, the late 19th or early 20th century by an engineer who was working out in that region. And there's, you know, they're on a trail, they're on a signposted trail, but you do have to hike or have a 4x4 to get up there. Previously, I mean, they've not been identified, as far as I'm aware, until this point, as mushrooms. And I think previously the images were identified as arrows. However, if you take a look at these images, they're not pointed, for starters. You know, the top is hemispherical in profile. And the shafts are in proportion to the caps in terms of a mushroom. So if they were to be interpreted as arrows, it would be a very schematic kind of drawing. And not only that, but the shafts.
That reminds me of the interpretation, I think, that was by Letcher of trying to interpret the Tassilian Ajir mushroom shaman as arrows. Mm. And he argues that the drawing by Cat Harrison, may be a fraud or something. But recently, I saw an actual photograph of the Tassilian Ajir mushroom shaman man, and it looks identical to what Cat Harrison drew out. And she did a very good job on the drawing.
Indeed, but then there are the other figures, the Tassili figures, aren't they? The running figures, which are sort of mushroom-headed figures, aren't they?
Right,
Holding figures. I mean, of course, you know, I'll talk a little bit about, you know, sort of history and so on and doing history later, but there are issues over interpretation. But some of these images, to anybody who's ever had a mushroom experience, you look at that and say, no, that's a guy who's high on mushrooms. You know, that's what it is. You know, so it may be obvious to us, but to argue the case, you've got to construct, you know, a solid argument before you're going to convince the establishment.
Well, and it's not only, I was just going to add, it's not only important that somebody has experienced them, but if somebody really wants to know what they're like, they need to have, like, a full-blown mystical experience like Stan Grof or Roland Griffiths talks about. They can't just have, you know, one of these light experiences and think they understand what the mushroom or psychedelic experience is about.
Oh, indeed. You know, and that goes into a whole area of, you know, are you compromised sort of academically, if you like, for example, by having had the experience? And I think the argument is absolutely not. Yet on the other hand, you know, if you're writing in an academic kind of scenario, then it's probably not something that you're going to discuss. But I mean, but that's another argument, an important one, I think, that has to be addressed. And it's a bridge we have to get over in terms of dealing with the whole history of entheogens and so on, that prejudice, as it were. I think I said earlier, you know, that if you're a marine biologist, then you're not prejudiced by having a love of the sea and the experience of the ocean and so on. So, but to return to these mushroom images and the arrow interpretation that we were talking about, actually some of the shafts, as it were, or the stems of the mushrooms are actually zigzag shaped. So not very arrow-like in that sense. And I don't know if you're familiar with this yarn, but this a zigzag stem is actually typical of certain psilocybin mushrooms. For example, the psilocybin semilanciata, the Liberty Cap, which grows here in the UK, and I think it grows in the States as well, is a popular psilocybin mushroom for picking, for those who enjoy the mushroom experience. This zigzag stem is typical of certain species. So Carl was alerted to this, Carl Ruck, so Carl and I, together with Jose Celdron, organised a trip to Cuenca in central Spain, close to the site of the mushrooms, and out there we met up with two Spanish archaeologists. One who's researched extensively on shamanism and prehistoric rock art, and another who has actually just completed his doctorate on the rock art of that region, including the mushroom petroglyphs. And it was him who was able to give us access directly to the sites. So otherwise you'd be trying to photograph and so on, or interpret it through the bars, as it were, of these cages constructed around them. Anyhow, in the meantime, I'd alerted Brian Ackers to the find, and been in correspondence with him for some time, and Brian is in contact with Dr. Gaston Guzman in Mexico, and Dr. Guzman's a world expert on psilocybe species, and he was fascinated by this find. and Dr. Guzman has tentatively identified these images as being Psilocybe hispanica, a psilocybe containing species which is quite closely related to the well-known Liberty Cap that I talked about, the Psilocybe semilanciata. And Dr. Guzman associates the bull who's featured on the same rock face with the mushrooms, because the psilocybe hispanica is one of these dung loving species, so Dr. Guzman certainly sees that as supporting evidence that these definitely are mushroom images, but of course all of this has to be worked out in detail. And a joint paper is planned between Carl Ruck, Dr. Guzman, the Spanish experts on the site, and on Spanish rock art and shamanism in general. And Brian Ackers is taking up the editorial role there, and he's doing brilliantly on that, actually, coordinating between these different kinds of approaches, this multidisciplinary approach of the mycological, the archaeological, and the mythological, I guess, are the key elements that are going to be brought together.
I think with Brian's background, he would be good at that.
He's doing a great job, as I said. In the meantime, and when that paper will come out, who knows? It'll have to be completed, and then, of course, you know, it'll have to be submitted, and so on. But in the meantime, Carl is going to be treating on the rock art in his forthcoming book, Mushrooms, Myths, and Mithras, the Drug Cult That Civilized Europe, which I'm sure you're aware of, Jan. Available for pre-order right now on Amazon, and that's certainly going to be an exciting publication published by City Lights, isn't it?
I've been trying to, talk him into letting me review that one. I don't know if he'll let me or not, but we'll see.
Due for publication shortly in any event. Take a look on Amazon, those who are interested. It's already up there.
I noticed that.
Due for publication soon. Anyhow, the importance of this rock art, you mentioned Andy Letcher and the Tassili rock art and so on, and Andy Letcher argues in his book Shroom that there's no evidence for the prehistoric use of psychoactive mushrooms, but there is.
And of course he does a very poor job at analyzing. Like I said, the Cat Harrison drawing of the Tassili and Ajir, you know, if you look in it, where I saw the photograph is actually in Professor Michael Winkelman and John Baker's new book, Supernatural is Natural. Mm-hmm. And there's an actual photograph of it there, and his whole argument falls apart.
Now, I would say about that that he does raise some fair methodological criticisms, you know, and my view on that is that they have
places.
To be addressed, yeah. But I must mention, you know, in relation to Tassili, that there are some rock art from there, very suggestive of Armanita Muscaria as well. And if you've not seen that, I'll let you have an image from a book of that. But that's an aside. But I mean, returning to the issue of evidence. Now, plainly, there is the difficulty that mushrooms leave very little evidence. So although we've got in the Pecos Valley, you've got evidence of peyote usage going back to whatever about, is it 6,000 years BC, 4,000 years BC. But anyway, a very long time ago. So you've got physical evidence of the use of peyote active materials going back to that era. But then there is the rock art at the Pechtimel site in Kamchatka. And are you familiar with that, Jan?
Yes, and I believe that is in Persephone's Quest right at the beginning of the book. I'm looking at it right now. It's right at the beginning of the book there. He's got the artwork and everything laid out there.
There's a few images in there, not particularly high quality, if I remember rightly.
Correct.
But there's a DVD called Pechtimel, made by a Russian anthropologist called Andrei Golovnev, and it's about the Chukchi people of that part of Kamchatka, who still use the Armanita Muscaria, the fly agaric. And so you have this site where you've got the indigenous population still using Armanita, and you have got rock art, which is, it is difficult to be sure of the particular era, described as Bronze Age. So we're talking 3,000, maybe 4,000 years BC. And in this particular DVD, there's a Chukchi elder talking about his experiences on fly agaric. And it's really fascinating. He talks about visiting the realm of the dead, and those who died by fire, they are in one place, and those who died by water, they're in another. And it's a struggle to find his way through. He feels that he's lost. And the way that he finds his way home is by singing. So this, to me, is an important connection with the Amerindian traditions of entheogenic mushroom usage and ayahuasca and so on, the importance of song in navigating, if you like, the entheogenic experience. And one of the other things that stood out to me there is he's speaking about the experience that he had, and his wife says to him, you saw such and such. And he says, no. He says, the mushrooms saw. And again, this idea that it's the mushrooms who see is an important commonality between mushroom experiences in different cultures. But anyhow, it's a fascinating DVD. It's available through the internet. So if you put in Pechtimel, Google Pechtimel and DVD or something like that, you'll turn it up. I mean, there's very little ethnographic material available on them on fly agaric usage, and this is a very important contribution. Again, there's another DVD. I don't know if you're familiar, Jan, with The Song of Muckamore.
Somewhat.
That was filmed by Tom Stimson. That's a record. Muckamore, of course, being the Russian for fly agaric. Muckamore meaning fly killer. The Russian name for the Armanita Muscaria, and that documents an expedition led by Gary Linkoff, and he's an important figure in the mycological world. I think he edited the Audubon Guide to Mushrooms and so on. But that's a fascinating adventure. So anyone who wants to look at the contemporary usage and evidence for the contemporary usage and the ethnographic background to the use of Armanita should get hold of that as well. Song of Muckamore. Anyhow, Lecher. Yes, coming back to Andy Lecher, that sort of leads us back, I suppose, to the history of ideas, and I'll talk about that maybe. Maybe then, but one of the criticisms of Lecher of Wasson, if I remember right, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Jan, is that He says that most of Watson's accounts, the traveler's tales of Flyagric intoxication, are not in a truly shamanic context. You know, that there's not actually a record of the, in inverted commas, shamanic use of Flyagric.
And, right, and well, and again, I think one of the confusions that he makes is that, you know, he thinks that somehow there's a separation between healing and spiritual shamanic use, and traditionally these two practices are intertwined. And
do you know, I very much agree with you there. And really to separate out necessarily what might be seen as recreational from spiritual or usage, if you like, or shamanic usage and so on, it's a continuous line, really, which you can't necessarily. And, of course, there is the prejudices of those who were observing the use of it, who saw it as a crude intoxicant, and that's another aspect. But there are, you know, anthropological investigations into the use of Flyagric, and I quote some of those in my paper on Burak, on Muhammad's ecstatic ascent, and where Burak is depicted as a Flyagric. I think you'll find in the Journal of Ethnopharmacology, I think it is, a lady, I think it is called Marit Saar, she's written a couple of times about the use of Flyagric in anthropological studies, and I think really the whole area is under research. And of course there may well be materials in Russian or other languages that we're not aware of, I think it's an area that needs a lot more investigation, that people haven't gone looking. So,
well, you know, I just wonder what's written in Farsi and you know, on the Zoroastrians alone, you know, not even to think about Russian and all the Slavic languages, and you know, there's got to be stuff in former Yugoslav republics that go into that stuff as well.
Absolutely, it's not. And I turned up some Hungarian stuff in English, which was very interesting. Yes, I mean it's wide open. So I think that into this realm of research, researchers from other countries and other cultures need to be drawn in. And who knows what we're going to discover? It's a very exciting area.
Well, let me ask you, why do you think it's so important that entheogenic researchers take a more academically rigorous approach, since we're on this topic?
Well, I mentioned earlier primary and secondary sources, and crudely speaking, for those who are not familiar with that, that means primary means like original documents or artifacts, say, you know, the New Testament scriptures or the Nag Hammadi texts or artwork, sculpture, rock art, and so on, and secondary sources being academic studies or other commentary which interprets and evaluates those primary sources.
Right.
And if you're going to sort of do history, as it were, or if you're going to produce studies that are going to be taken seriously academically, then both of those need to be critically evaluated and put into context. You know, not just used to support your hypothesis. You know, I think sometimes there's a danger amongst amateur researchers, and I put myself in that class, of just thinking it's enough to sort of just accumulate evidence to support your hypothesis.
Well, so, you need to really triangulate. You need to, you know, which is what I tried to do in The Holy Mushroom. I think hopefully I succeeded in that, but, you know, my primary... supporting it by iconography, by textual evidence, by psychological evidence, and by analysis of the arguments that were there. And hopefully, you know, like I said, I hit that.
No, I was very impressed by your work there, Jan. But there's another aspect as well, I think, which is to say that your own research, when you're doing research, has to be put into context. That means to say that, you know, you've got to acknowledge competing theories, and show an awareness of all existing scholarship concerning your topic.
You know? Right, exactly.
So if you want, you know, that is if you want to play that game, academic game.
Right.
Maybe we do, maybe we don't.
Well, you know, and in that regard, referring back to Andy Letcher, which is one of the points that Michael Hoffman brought up in his critical analysis of Andy Letcher's book Shroom was that he focuses primarily on older research. He focused on Wasson, Allegro, and Terence McKenna, and omitted the stuff by you and Samarini and most of Ruck's newer research, and he probably wasn't aware of mine. His treatment of Heinrich's work was to bash him for talking about his experience rather than dealing with the evidence he presents directly. Wow. And so I don't know if that's where you were going with that, but that seems to be right along those same lines.
Well, certainly there. I mean, I think everything that you say there is fair. I mean, as a matter of fact, I've met Andy, and he's a lovely guy. So let's not alienate Andy from the fold, so to speak. And he may be developing a different approach now.
Yeah, good point.
Because let's say that it was fairly clear from Andy's work that at one point he was infatuated, so to speak, with Terence McKenna. He makes that relatively clear within the
right.
book. And I feel that in Shroom he was a little bit on the rebound from that. He wanted to be taken seriously. It's a kind of quasi academic work. And I think he's working to one degree or another, at least under supervision. So let's see what Andy has to say for himself. But I did feel that he stooped a little bit low in terms of his treatment of Wasson and Leary.
Well, what about Allegro? I mean, first he...
Oh, and Allegro, I'm sorry.
Well, you know, first what he does is that he says, Wasson's research is invalid, and then he uses Wasson's research against Allegro to attack Allegro, and all of the points that he brought up against Allegro have been refuted.
Well, indeed, and you cover all of this in The Holy Mushroom.
Right.
But if I could return for a moment to history and make perhaps a final point. I mean, I'm not an expert myself. I had the benefit of studying historical method, but that was a long time ago, or 20, 25 years ago. But in terms of history itself, you know, there are competing theories of history. You might say, you know, from the left to the right, as it were, from the liberal to the conservative. And at one extreme, you know, there's the view that history is irretrievable, you know, that it can only ever represent a kind of imaginative reconstruction, which is so imbued with our own cultural prejudices that we can't be certain that it in any way truly depicts what happened in the past. That's one far extreme. And at the other end, there are those who think, well, yes, you can recover, you know, history in a relatively objective way by you know, practicing a certain kind of discipline. But then purely plainly the history of the Second World War is going to be very different if it's written from an Allied perspective or a German perspective or a Russian perspective or a Japanese perspective and so on. But it's just to say that these are issues that if we think if we're doing history, if we want to have that ambition to do history in a way which will be taken seriously in terms of, you know, the history of entheogens and entheogens and religion, then we have to have an awareness of these kinds of issues in the way that we're working. As if we want to take academia on, as it were, which we may or may not be inclined to do, but that was my original game plan, as it were, but I kind of put that on hold, at least in terms of the bigger picture, you know.
Right. You asked me to introduce this podcast with music by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan called Dum Dum Mast Colander. What was the intention behind the music there?
Well, I used that music to introduce my talk at Entheogenesis in Vancouver, and this song is performed by this Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, and he's a world renowned performer of Islamic devotional music, and he's from Pakistan and in Pakistan and in India as well. He's, you know, probably seen really as a saint, I suppose. He's now deceased, but and he's much loved in the kind of world music as well. So he's known not just amongst Islamic audiences, but, you know, by world music fans and so on. And anyhow, it's Mast Mast Kalendar. Well, One of the reasons that I asked you to use it, one of the reasons that I played it in Vancouver is, you know, sometimes we get caught up in discussions about entheogens and kind of forget the significance of the entheogenic experience itself. And this music reminds us of that, you know, that ecstatic communion with the Godhead, which, you know, which entheogens can provide, and the sort of traditions that are associated with it. So that the lyrics, Dum Mas Kalendar, means something like, go, go, you crazy calendar. And a calendar is a Sufi. He's one of the wilder, kind of Sufi orders, the calendars, and they go back at least until, or something like the 13th century or so, I think the records of the calendars. And so mast meaning intoxicated. Actually, this word turns up in English. You'll find it in an English dictionary, but spelled as must, M-U-S-T, that you may have heard of, Jan, which is the frenzy that elephants get into in the rutting season, that male elephants get into, and elephants must.
I've heard some about that.
It's the same word, must. It's come to us from Hindi, probably, or from Urdu. But it's, again, there's an Iranian connection. It's an Iranian word, and it turns up in Sanskrit as well, meaning drunk or intoxicated. And so it's referring to, yes, to God intoxication, but also there's a clear connection with the fact that the calendars were well known for the use of hashish, of cannabis, and so on.
And I think it's interesting also that elephants have a history of liking alcohol as well.
That's an interesting connection. But if I can tell you something even more interesting, potentially, which is that that this word turns up in Celtic mythology. So you have this Irish goddess called Medd, which means intoxicated.
And it's also the word for honey in many languages.
That's right. It's all connected. So the Irish goddess Medd, who is this powerful female figure who, you know, exhausts male sexuality, battles cease when she menstruates, and she's a goddess of intoxication and so on. And she turns up in Shakespeare as Queen Mab. I think she turns up in Romeo and Juliet. And there's an interesting little section in there where Queen Mab, soliloquy of some kind about Queen Mab. But here we have a wonderful connection from one end of Eurasia to the other, you know, so from Irish mythology all the way to Pakistan, we have this same word which refers to intoxication and intoxication in a religious and powerful mythological context. So this, you know, is evidence for the extreme antiquity of the mythologies connected with intoxication and the significance of intoxication in a religious context. But the calendars are fascinating because, you know, the descriptions of them. So they were these sort of Sufi characters, if you like. I mean, when we say they're Sufis, what we're saying really is that they're mystical people who devoted themselves to poverty and mystical experience, you know, wandering from place to place. They've been documented since around the 13th century, wandering right across from India across through to Turkey and so on. And the descriptions of them are that they wandered naked, or they wore animal skins. They decorated themselves with animal teeth or bones. They practiced scarification. They painted their bodies. They pierced their bodies, and they loved to take hashish and to play music, all of which were central to their spiritual practice. They wandered carrying their musical instruments. And they like to sleep on the ground. I remember it was one of the things that was said about them. And what occurs to me when I read those descriptions, which you'll find in a fascinating book called God's Unruly Friends, by an author called Kara Mustafa, is, you know, no one would notice them at Burning Man. You know, they'd fit straight in. You know, these characters from the 12th century, described in the 12th century.
Very fascinating.
Anyhow, that was, yes, that was, if I haven't quite lost the plot, that was the reason for having Masked Mask Kalendar, go, go, you crazy Kalendar, you know. But it's a terrifically popular song. You'll find it on YouTube. You'll find it in Bollywood versions and then in more restrained devotional renditions and so on. But God's Unruly Friends, Kara Mustafa, K-A-R-A-M-U-S-T-A-F-A, one of the rare books about the use of cannabis in a Sufi kind of context. And of course, there's The Herb by Rosenthal. So anybody interested in that should check out those books. But these characters and this way of life, it's, you know, it's something that's, one suspects, has always existed. It exists now, the wandering sadhus in India, and those who follow like a Rasta way of life, for example, in the Caribbean, and devote themselves to smoking the herb and living a spiritual life.
So, well,
but if I can just say, can I say one more thing? I'm sorry, Anne. Yes, one more point regarding Sufism. It's all right, you know, we talk about Sufism as if we know something about it. At least I do. As if I do, but I mean, it's a massive subject, and Sufism, you know, it really just means the mystical aspect of Islam, and Sufism itself, you know, ranges from extremely conservative orders, you know, through to these groups that are described as Sufis, which are extremely heterodox, you know, extremely unorthodox, and would be regarded with suspicion, alarm, or you know, complete distaste by conservative Islam.
You, well, you know what? I want to ask you before I go into the next subject on cannabis. You had mentioned to me briefly about a 19th century ethnographer that had laid out some of the themes in Wasson's research.
Well, actually, that's in connection with what I anticipated you asking me about. My paper called "The Mysterious Origins of the Word Marijuana," yes, this man called James Gregory Burke. He was a Civil War veteran and a very early ethnographer of Amerindian culture. He travelled down to Mexico, it was him. It's James Gregory Burke, who's actually cited as the earliest person to refer to something called something like marijuana. So my paper was really about the mysterious etymological origins of the word marijuana, and that went into some interesting areas. The possibility, for starters, that there could be a Chinese connection,
right? From the word ma, or however it's pronounced.
That's right, ma hua.
Right.
Now Weston T. LaBarre, you know, the famous ethnographer who studied peyote and so on, he suggested that it might be a Chinese connection. And the Chinese actually were in contact with the west coast of the Americas, you know, probably before the Europeans, but certainly soon after, and they were trading and fishing and so on. Anyhow, ma renhua in Chinese would mean cannabis seed flower, so there seemed to be a possible connection there. But other sources maybe as well. But there was an interesting question which arises there, which is, you know, did cannabis exist in the Americas before the arrival of the Europeans? And the Spanish and the Portuguese brought it because it was an important for naval technology, as you're probably aware. But there are some papers which cover forensic analysis of ancient mummies from Peru, which show the presence of cannabinoids and also in mummies from Egypt. So those are papers by someone called Balabanova, which are, you know, they are in I think, forensic journals or something of that kind of order. Anyhow, yes, looking for the etymology of marijuana, which is unknown, but James Gregory Burke uses this word for the first time in an article he was writing about the culture of Mexico in a popular magazine called Scribner's. But looking into Burke's work, he published a book which might be regarded as notorious, called The Scatologic Rites of All Nations. And I have to give you the full title because it's so interesting. Called The Scatologic Rites of All Nations, a dissertation upon the employment of excrementious remedial agents in religion, therapeutics, divination, witchcraft, love filters, etc., in all nations. And it goes on to say, a compilation of notes and memoranda bearing upon the use of human ordure and human urine in rites of religious or semi-religious character among various nations. And as you might imagine, this was published in the 18th century, I believe, the title bears the warning, not for general perusal. Which would mean that in libraries it would be put in that, you know, that locked room where only, you know, adults who've been given permission are allowed to have a look at this book.
Well, let me ask you, is that something is that a reference that Wasser knew about?
Well, now there's a question, and I haven't exhaustively checked. I did a word search on versions I have of Mushrooms, Russia, and History, and it didn't turn up a result. Now, given that, you know, the title involves notes and memoranda upon the use of human ordure and human urine in rites of a religious or semi-religious character, it would be very hard to imagine that Wasson was not aware of it. But I've not seen a credit. But the remarkable thing is, if I just tell you, and this book is, you will find it through the internet. You can probably download it as a PDF somewhere. But Burke, in this book of his, which when it was published in the German edition, I should add, he had a preface by Sigmund Freud. No, it was a serious study, not just for titillation, as it were.
Right.
Anyhow. Yes, he made a detailed study, you know, of travelers' reports of the Central Asian use of fly agaric, you know, both for sort of shamanic and recreational intoxication. And he cites at least 15 authorities, which he reviews. And importantly, you know, he speculated that the taboo surrounding mushrooms was based on their power to intoxicate. So that's, you know, that's item number two, so to speak. And he identifies fly agaric as not merely recreational, but as a sacred intoxicant, and refers to the importance of the mushroom as speaking to the intoxicated individual. And finally, he makes a connection between the Siberian use of fly agaric and the Mexican use of psilocybe. So, I mean, I'll just give you a quote there to give you an idea. He says that some such use of poisonous fungi, as has been shown exists among the tribes of Siberia, was made by other nations would be difficult to prove in the absence of direct testimony. But many incidental references are encountered which the reflective mind must consider with care before rejecting them as absolutely irrelevant in this connection. The Mexicans, as we learn from Sahagun, were not ignorant of the mushroom, which is described as the basis of one of their festivals. So, I mean, there's some words which we could all take on board.
Yeah, and, well, that's very fascinating stuff.
And that was published in, it'd be the late 19th century, I would say. And here's another one. He actually links the use of fly agaric with the Soma of the Vedic scriptures. He quotes from somebody else in this connection, I think, and he says, speaking of the orgy, that's to say, you know, the ancestral, as it were, an orgy, of course, in this context doesn't mean, you know, like a sexual orgy. It means, you know, religious ecstasy in the Greek meaning or Roman meaning of the word.
Right.
Speaking of the orgy of the Siberians, having witnessed the use of Armanisa in Siberia, this person he quotes his comments that these intoxicants, which nowadays are used to produce mere excitement or brutal drunkenness, were at first looked upon as media able to raise the mere man up to the level with his gods and enable him to communicate with them, as was certainly the case with the Soma of the Hindu ecstatics. Well, anyhow, there's, you know, a very interesting point of reference that even those of us who are, you know, quite familiar with most of the research on mushrooms may not be familiar with, and one for those who have not seen it before to look out.
Right. Very, very fascinating information. That's, you know, with my own research that I'm conducting right now, that could have a huge significance to my own work. But, you know, I'll have to look into that a little bit more.
Sure, we can discuss that another time, Jan. But, yes, we'll return to it, I'm sure.
Is there some aspect of your work? Let me change that. What do you think is the most important aspect of your research?
Well, the work that that you've been able to see, Jan, published and unpublished, and I've been a little bit lazy in some ways about pushing to get some of it published. As I said, I attempted to apply the methodologies that I'd learned as an undergraduate, and that leads to a sort of very detailed and critical kind of approach. And you know, and when that was my mission, if you like, to apply that methodology, I felt a little disappointed in some entheogenic writings, if you like, in as much as I felt they didn't really live up to those standards, and that I was anxious to see a critical, you know, academy to be convinced of the sort of the importance of the role of entheogens in religious history and potentially in a Christian context, for example. So that's one aspect, I guess, but it's not the only way, and that's really why not the only way to approach these issues, and that's why I wanted to say a little bit about Carl's work and myth and the language of myth as another way of approaching it. And some people may find, you know, they don't need any convincing in terms of a very academic or scholarly kind of approach. So I think it's to say that there's different ways of approaching it. I'd like to see, and you're certainly working extremely hard, Jan, in this kind of area. I would like to see that discipline applied to entheogenic studies, and for a dubious academy to be brought around in due course. But it's not the only way. So I guess that that's, I guess that that's my message. Yes, you know the Gospel according to St. Thomas there, Jan, at all? I'm sure you do.
In the Nag Hammadi, the Gnostic scripture?
The Nag Hammadi, yeah. But in there it says, "Let him who seeks not cease until he finds. When he finds, he will become troubled. When he is troubled, he will wander, and he will reign over all." And so let us all keep seeking. But let's not forget what St. Paul said, which he says, "If I know all mysteries and knowledge but have not love, I'm nothing." So these subjects can be fascinating and engrossing and all-consuming, but knowledge and knowledge of mysteries isn't everything. Mm.
And is there anything that we haven't brought up in this discussion that you would like to touch on quickly?
No, except that there's a very long way to go and there's a great deal to be discovered. And I look forward to developments in entheogenic researches over the next 10, 20, 30 years. And I hope I'm around that long to see those developments.
Well said, and I certainly concur with that. Let me ask you, do you have any contact information or website information, any upcoming book projects, et cetera, that you would like to discuss?
Well, for the moment, I'll just mention what's available of my work through the web. There was the talk that I gave on the use of entheogens in Islamic gnosis, and that's available at pot-tv.net. Though the link doesn't seem to be working right now, but hopefully that's Chris Bennett's site, Hopefully Chris will get that sorted out.
Actually, Chris is no longer working with that site anymore, so we'll have to write them. And I already emailed Chris about it, and he said his response was that he hasn't worked with them for 2 or 3 years.
Oh, is that right? Oh, well, I'm out of date there. I'm out of date. But it was working till really quite recently because I had visited it relatively recently. Well, unfortunately, that may no longer be available at all. My paper on the mysterious origins of the word marijuana that has, I think, all kinds of interesting bits and pieces in it. It's not just a technical etymological study. You can find that through Sino-Platonic Papers on the web. That's Sino-Platonic Papers, and if you look for mysterious origins of the word marijuana, you'll discover that it's available for download at a fairly small price, I think, or for a hard copy. And finally, my paper on psychoactive milk and meat, which I think you've had a chance to look at, Jan. That appears to be available through something called Payloads, payloads.com. And I think that that must have found its way there through through Mark Hoffman. That paper was originally due to be published in the journal Entheos, the Journal of Psychedelic Spirituality. But unfortunately, that's been on hold for a number of years now.
Right.
But that paper... the milk of the goat Hydrun, Heidrun, can be found through payloads with a Z, .com.
And we've been speaking with Alan Piper, and this concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 30. Alan, very fascinating information. I really appreciate you coming on, and this is going to be a... fantastic follow-up to Wolfgang Bauer's interview from last week, so I'm glad that I was able to have both of you on back-to-back. That worked out very well, very supportive information.
Well, that's great, Jan. I very much enjoyed talking to you and look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
And that concludes my interview with Alan Piper. And right there at the end, I said that was podcast number 30. That was because... it was before it was split into two pieces from being so long. So that's actually podcast number 31. And once again, next week will be Dr. Neil Goldsmith on psychedelics and psycho-spiritual development. Until next week.